The Ensemble podcast is intended for professional financial advisors. All discussion is limited to publicly available information and should not be interpreted as legal, professional, or financial advice. Ensemble does not hold an AFS license nor provide any financial services. Before making investment decisions, you should obtain financial advice from a qualified financial advisor.
Hello, my name's James Wrigley. I'm a financial advisor and one of the principals of Melbourne-based financial planning firm First Financial. I've been a long-term listener and contributor to the Ensemble Group and podcast, picking up some amazing nuggets of gold over the years. And through this podcast and the people that I'm able to speak to and interview, hopefully I can continue to deliver some of those nuggets of gold to you.
A Challenger Lifetime Annuity can do more for portfolio outcomes. A combination of income streams, blending a Challenger Lifetime Annuity with other sources of retirement income, such as an account-based pension, means your clients can get the best of both worlds, guaranteed regular income for life and access to capital as needed. Help more clients do more, live more, create more. Contact your Challenger BDM or visit challenger.com.au/portfolio-outcomes. For a retirement portfolio that can deliver more, read and consider the Challenger Lifetime Annuity, Liquid Lifetime, PDS and TMD from challenger.com.au.
Hello and welcome back to the podcast. I am back this week. I think last week's episode said I was on holidays. I was just jammed for trying to record an episode. But today I have the pleasure of speaking with Josh Derrington, CIO at Alvia Asset Partners. Josh, thank you for joining me on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me.
Now, it's always good to just get a start on what is Alvia Asset Partners first off, and then we'll kind of talk about your story. I think would be interesting, certainly for me, from what I've read about you. Tell us, Alvia Asset Partners, what are you up to?
Yeah, so essentially we are an investment management firm that specializes in investing money for family offices, so wholesale clients, predominantly family offices, of which one is my own. And we can talk about family offices in general, but it's obviously very topical. You're reading and hearing a lot about the emergence of family offices, but we manage money across multiple asset classes for family offices.
Yep. And what about, so you've been doing it for a while. It's like, you spoke about your own kind of family office, whatever's happening there. There's some family assets. And so you in the beginning, you were working on helping manage family assets and then you've gone to start your own business. Is that, can you tell us about what that's like?
Yeah, sort of. And so basically, so I guess for most people in finance, I've come from an institutional background in finance. I guess institutional money manager didn't really suit my style or my personality type. I think I struggled with the concept of managing to a relative benchmark that I didn't quite appreciate. And I was more of an absolute return minded person. I left the industry to try and do my own thing in business and was lucky enough to have some success and sell the business and realize some capital, and it forced me to really think about how I wanted to manage my own money and what I thought would, this was a blank piece of paper sort of moment, and how I could build a firm that suited me and my personality and invest with some people that I knew and I guess friends. Yeah. And fortunately enough, some other families have sort of bought into that philosophy, and that was sort of how Alvia Asset Partners came about.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So what was the business that you made and sold, was that in and around investing, or was that something completely different?
No, bizarrely completely outside of investment world. A client had an asset, and they actually approached me before they went to a competitive process and said, Josh, we think this, your skill set, sort of temperament might suit this business. It was in the education sector. So my wife and I took that on. Leveraged everything we had and sold our house and had a go. And fortunately enough, it worked, and we learned lots of lessons along the journey. And since then, we've done a couple of other things in private markets. I started a healthcare business with one of my best friends, which we sold part of to private equity. I'm still sit on the board and invested in that business. But yeah, it forced us to really think about what we wanted to do long term with our own wealth, and as I said, other families have sort of bought into that philosophy.
How old are you?
I'm 41.
You've done so much for 41 Thanks. Years old. Thanks, That's man. Incredible.
Yeah.
Good on you. So how do you get that transition from, you know, you knew a bit about financial markets from working, obviously you've, you know, gone and done something else and a success at that, you sold a business, you've made some money, you then turn your attention to kind of investing your own money, essentially. How do you then go from investing your own money to getting other people to invest with you? How does that transition happen?
Yeah, I personally thought there was a gap in the market for really absolute return focused investing.
Yeah.
And I mean, I just put it back to my own experience. When I go home to my wife at night, she doesn't ask how we performed against an arbitrary benchmark.
It's true.
She asks how we're going to afford the school fees. So I think we're very selective around who we take on as clients. So and I think the way we write and the way we present ourselves, you know, I get aligns with certain types of people, and those types of people tend to be families that have had some sort of liquidity event of some description and are navigating that transition from actively managing something, whether it be a business, to a passive pool of capital. And it's just, it requires a totally different mindset. Yeah. But ultimately, it comes down to the core of capital allocation, whether that be asset allocation in a passive environment where you choose to place your capital, or in a business where you're allocating capital, whether it be maintenance or growth CapEx. And I think a lot of people struggle with that transition from operating to investing, or that they believe they're very good at operating and therefore that makes them a great investor.
Yeah.
And that sometimes is, a lot of the times, is not the case.
I would imagine your own lived experience helps in that regard. Like, I'm sure, and as we all do in financial advice, often, you know, we're retelling stories of what we've done ourselves or what someone else has done that you've helped. I would imagine you having done that yourself, from being a kind of owner operator of a business, mm-hmm. To selling it to then managing, you've done that transition yourself. I'd imagine there's a degree of comfort in some of the families that you're working with that you've been through it yourself before. Would that be right?
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you go back to the everyone's read the Buffett letters. He talks about how he is a better investor for the fact that he's been, you know, closely, you know, operated inside a board and had some insight into business itself. It's certainly, and most of it's just lessons from making mistakes.
Yeah.
And I think from both perspectives, you're managing risk. If you're inside a business, you're managing the risk. You're navigating the messiness of a business and the humans, and trying to get them aligned around a story and a message and a vision. And it's the same principle in times of inside an investment portfolio. You're managing risk. You're clearly considering where the capital goes to generate the best returns for the least amount of risk, and thinking through opportunity costs. So absolutely, it's made me a better investor. And it's purely because I've made mistakes and I've learned from them and iterated. I think perhaps families buy into that because they can see that we're not trading tickers, we're contemplating investments in businesses and thinking about it with perhaps a longer term mindset than the average person inside investment markets.
Yeah.
So
But like we deal with, like, in kind of retail world where most of my financial advice, clients and work sits, you're coming up against this idea of people that don't have any experience in financial markets, you know, have never invested in share markets before. They kind of liken it to gambling. So I'm going to buy this stock, and they're kind of just punting that to say that I'm trying to make a fortune. It's like, hang on, you're actually becoming a part owner in BHP. You're a part owner of that business. Now, someone else is controlling and operating and running that business, but you own part of the business. You're buying into the long-term prospects of this business, not punting on trying to make a fortune tomorrow and then selling it. Like, it's not the casino.
Yeah, it's a pet peeve of mine. I don't know how we fix it, but yeah, that sort of gambling fallacy when it comes to markets. And it's funny, you'll see same people who are happy to walk into a casino and gamble and then relate that back to what they do inside investment markets. And just it's frustrating. But as you said, what a privilege to be able to participate in an investment market where you can literally offer no active involvement to the business, but go along for the ride. It's fantastic. And you get to do that while you enjoy your time with your family. I think it's an underappreciated privilege.
I like the way you put that. I like that. Can we spend a bit of time talking about family offices? So I've never worked in a family office. I work, as I said, in a broadly retail-focused financial advice business. I get the odd phone call from people that they're calling saying, we've got certain assets like this. I think we need a family office offering. What is a family office?
Yeah, I think it's becoming overused, but I also think they're emerging for a reason. I think there is clearly more capital around that is interested in buying things, and most of them are operating businesses, which is creating a pool of capital for people who have the need to employ people to service that pool of capital. So a family office is basically that. It's a passive pool of capital that has people in and around it doing things, whether it's if they're, and they're not all the same. They're clearly very, very different, and they come in different shapes and sizes. But yeah, whether that's administration, so employing accountants to help with reporting and managing these passive assets, whether it's property managers servicing the property asset allocation within a family office, whether it's private equity individuals representing them in their other investments outside of their core business, or it's investment managers like us, which serve a role for them around their capital. So it's a pool of capital. It's probably been realized in where it could be multi-generational, or it could be realized in the last 10 years and it's their first iteration of the family office.
Yeah.
Doing things with that pool of capital and managing risk and attempting to generate a real return over time to allow that capital to transition to the next generation inside the family.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's two types. So there's a single family office, which is exactly what I've described. And then there's multi-family offices, which basically service wealthy individuals who probably don't have the capacity to build their own single family office. Yeah. So I hope that makes sense.
Yeah. So you kind of got at the wealthier end, they've got enough money to employ these people directly, accountants, bookkeepers, investment managers, lawyers, whatever it might be. And so they're employing people that might do like a lot of what an ordinary financial advisor does, but you're just employed solely to work on that family. And then that middle one is where there's a group of families would come together, or there's a business that's built to support a group of families where there's the accountants and the bookkeepers and the property managers and the investment managers and all of these kind of things, but they're maybe just working with half a dozen families or something like that. They're working with a small number of families.
Yep.
And then there's the financial advice type businesses where I work and a lot of listeners work, where you might work with 50 or 100 different clients, and they also have an accountant, and they also have a lawyer, and they also have a this and a that.
Yeah, exactly that. Yeah,
got it.
Yeah.
All right. As I said before we pressed record, you'd certainly hear a lot about family offices and what are they doing, and certain people calling our office suggesting that they need a family office offering. And it's just interesting to see what the differences are that are out there. So in terms of your investing, what are you doing? What are you seeing in terms of trends? Like what are you up to with the investing that you're doing?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we're absolute return focused. That doesn't mean we like to short a whole lot of things. It just means we think through our portfolios in terms of generating real returns. So we're pretty unconstrained. We don't abide by benchmarks. Even though we have an investment committee that's overseen by the ex-state head of QIC, who's very big on governance and still brings benchmarks to our attention. It's not how we invest. But we think about equity being equity, whether it's private or it's listed. Mm. We think about buying high-quality businesses and ideally getting them at a reasonable price point that allows us to generate a decent return over time. We also think in multi-asset classes, so we do believe in asset allocation being a legitimate risk management tool, but we take it a step deeper than that. There's the point where we I have my own portfolio managers who have worked in institutional environments. We have analysts. We are prepared to do active work on businesses. So we think we have an edge, and whether it's our analytical ability, probably not. It's more just our ability to control our temperament and manage a portfolio accordingly. So so long the short, we run a multi-asset class portfolio, which includes alternatives, fixed income, some REITs, Aussie and international equities, and then we very selectively will add private market opportunities from time to time, and not a huge number. It might be one a year where we think it's a really clear opportunity to generate outsized returns, basically. Yep. And we'll do that with inside an asset allocation mandates effectively.
So, like on the topic of REITs, for example, so there's like listed REITs in Australia, US, yep, wherever they may be. So there's something like that. Are you also getting into like buying the physical property, the shopping centre down the road? Like the shopping centre down the road from me, Woolworths bought that for $51 million or something.
Yeah,
is that the kind of thing that you would look at pooling with other groups like you to purchase something like that?
Exactly that. So we will pool very selectively. We are not property specialists. So we need a serious margin of safety to get comfortable with our sort of generalist ability in this space, or we need to co-invest with someone who we think has real institutional ability. So recently we took a stake in an office tower, which we thought was distressed, and we did that with an institutional partner. So I think we took a 20% stake in the building. That's the sort of thing we'll do from time to time. But I think prior to that, we hadn't done a property thing for sort of 5 years. So it's very selective on that sort of stuff.
Yeah. And can you talk a bit about like asset allocation? So and I suspect a lot of other financial advisors, our clients have an asset allocation, but the way that we're managing an asset allocation is a certain amount in cash, fixed interest, Aussie equities, overseas equities, those kind of things. Is that the style of asset allocation that you're managing, or is it more detailed than that? Like you have an asset allocation to private equity, you have an asset allocation towards listed equity because you're trying to manage liquidity and things like that. Like, hey, what level does your asset allocation go?
Probably very similar to what you guys do. And I think a lot of people tend to overcomplicate asset allocation because part of the time I think they're justifying their own existence. But I think about exactly the same way you do. We run a static asset allocation across our model portfolios. We just choose to do it inside our equity portfolios. We manage those portfolios directly. So to cut out that extra layer of fees or employing multiple active managers, we will do that ourselves. And then we also run an alternatives portfolio, which is largely illiquid, and has traditionally been uncorrelated with our portfolios. So, and I think probably the only difference for our wholesale clients is they're prepared to be a little bit more tactical in their asset allocation. So they're prepared to make or give us discretion to make more to tilt, basically. And we think you can generate some alpha doing that. So they give us some flexibility to do that. But ultimately, underlying it, it would be very similar to the asset allocations you mentioned.
Yeah. And so are there various investment options, for want of a better description, that you have? It's not just we have this one kind of fund where everything's going into, and then you're allocating across an asset allocation. There's different investment options.
Yeah, so we'll run SMAs, and then we have a unitized fund, and predominantly the unitized fund has been used for more second, third generation clients where they probably don't have the capital to buy into our SMAs, more diversified offerings. So we have a fund, but for our traditional client, they will give us a mandate, maybe $20 million, and they will dictate to us what their absolute return hurdle is. So whether it's 7-8%, let's use that number, then we will build and customize our asset allocation around our SMAs to execute on that hurdle. Does that make sense?
Right. So you're managing it on a, is it like on a client by client basis on the $20 million mandate, for example, rather than, hey, we'll put your $20 million into our bigger fund.
Exactly.
And we deliver the return that we deliver for everyone. It's more client by client basis.
It's client by client, but the underlying assets are the same. It'll just be different weightings to the asset classes. So we don't run, this is our conservative balanced. Our clients are they're fairly sophisticated, so they don't, their risk profiling is a different, it's a more of a conversation about, this is our whole of wealth, this is how we're thinking about how you're going to operate for us, this is the return we want you to generate with the least amount of risk. Yep. We'll go and build that asset allocation for them.
Yeah, and the SMA, is that, that's all listed assets, is
it? Predominantly, yeah, a lot of that is listed, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah. Yep. So, and the way we do, we will try and manage as much directly as we can, and inside our circle of competence, we think we can do that ourselves when it comes to equities. Outside of that, we will employ managers that are prepared to do something, or just do something differently that we would never be able to do ourselves in-house.
Yeah. I'm interested in how you come across opportunities in that kind of private space, private businesses. So where do they come from? How do you filter out the good from the bad? Like, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we see lots of bad. I think we've got a reasonable network now where I think people know what we do and what we don't do. We know a lot of accountants, a lot of lawyers, a lot of corporate advisors as well. So we're prepared to go in a competitive process. If we think we can offer some value, we've had experience in a fair few healthcare investments. So people will come to us with healthcare assets. But also where we get proactive opportunities come across our desk is the fact that we're prepared to take minority positions. So we're prepared to be a little bit different to your traditional private equity that wants to, no offense, I've got a lot of friends in private equity. They just have a very systemized process of, taking a majority position, taking control, navigating a 3-year window, exit planning from day one, 100-day plans, et cetera, et cetera. We just do it differently. So I think that suits a lot of founders and perhaps advisors who know us know that we might align with a certain founder. So we've just been very, very open around our communication, what we like and what we don't like. And we're probably prepared to buy more boring businesses than most private equity who want to invest behind tailwinds and thematics. And we don't really think that way. We like good boring businesses that generate cash flow and can turn up and that we can go into day one with not having to provide technical expertise, but perhaps provide some expertise around capital allocation and thinking through how are they going to transition the asset at some point in time in the future. What does the org chart look like? Is it a family business? Do they need to bring some people outside of the family into the business? Those sort of things. So,
you touched on it there because once you're starting to get into this private, private business world, depending on how much of a stake you take in that business, you may end up being in a position where you have to join the board and you have to kind of take control and operating and running that business. And so, on the one hand, you're running your own business and your own fund and all the rest of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you really want to? Do you have the expertise to actually take on responsibility for it? You happen to have invested in this business, but now because you've invested in it, you're now responsible for the outcomes of it versus just being a minority holder.
Yep.
You said you're kind of in this kind of longer term investment for maybe the cash flows that come from it.
Yeah. And if I've had to, or any of us have had to get intimately involved, it means there's been a mistake.
So. Yeah.
It means that something's gone astray. We've misjudged the people involved. I think the big thing with private capital that perhaps people that work in listed markets don't appreciate, it's a human game. You are really genuinely partnering with people. And if you get that wrong from the outset, you can spend a lot of time trying to fix it. So a lot of it is just, it's almost part psychology, getting your head around, can you trust these people and can they work together? And are they the type of people, because things will go wrong, they always do in business. Are they the type of people that can deal with adversity and they're resilient enough? Can they take feedback? Are they willing to listen? Those sort of things. So it's different to looking at a business through the context of listed markets where, it's this nice, clean, quantitative process buried up with some qualitative. ideas around moats and competitive advantage. And I mean, they're all really interesting things to talk through, but when it's private markets, that's why I say you can only do one, and we might be able to do one a year because it's a whole lot of work.
Yeah, and like in a completely different world, like a completely different lens to be thinking about versus what, you know, by and large, most of the, you know, financial advisors would be looking at, you know, for even those that some of them don't even go down to the direct stock level, but where you are going down to the direct stocks, yes, you know, you're looking at some research from all of these different research houses and drawing your own conclusions on it. That's a very different thought pattern to actually buying into someone's small business.
Absolutely.
And completely different. Right.
Mm. Yeah.
How do you, so you kind of commented there about, you know, it's more of the, you know, maybe boring, reliable stuff rather than some of the fun, exciting trends at the moment.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how it's all been going for you from a returns perspective?
Yeah. I mean, it's been fine. I would say, We're not value investors, but we're certainly very valuation minded. I think value investing is almost a dirty word these days, but I'm still a believer that value matters. We just think through quality first, and then apply, you know, pretty strict criteria and valuation. So it means we run more concentrated portfolios, and it means we sit on a lot of businesses or stocks for a long time before we invest in them, waiting for the right price or waiting for an event to create a price. Returns are good. I think I'm always get nervous when returns are good because it means the expectations build and it attracts the wrong people to our business. So
yeah.
I'm always thinking that's great, but that's all in the rearview mirror. I'm more conscious of what are the risks that are in our portfolio today as opposed to returns. But it's going okay.
And how do you manage the risk of the portfolio? Like, how are you dealing with that internally?
Yeah, it's interesting. So when running a fund is different to the SMAs. I think obviously the same philosophy is the biggest thing. Are we sticking to our knitting? Are we doing the right amount of work? Are we buying? I mean, risk management is a lot about price, and we run inside almost all our portfolios run IRRs. So we know, we get a pretty clear sense from our portfolio around what our expectations are. And when I see presently probably our IRRs are, you know, they're getting close to the point where we're adding more cash.
Mm.
So and risk is interesting. Asset allocation is a great means of risk management. But when you're running a more concentrated portfolio inside our fund, we have to think about risk differently. So we think about it in terms of what role does this position play inside the portfolio. So we break it down to compounding businesses. Obviously, everyone wants to own great compounders, and hold them forever. That's a really great way to generate a return. But sometimes they're just too expensive to hold forever. So we complement that with other, almost goes to the Peter Lynch style of investing, where we have asset value propositions, we have cyclicals. We just don't ever fall in love with our cyclicals or our asset plays. And then we hedge with very selective, you know, whether it's just simple hedges like owning treasuries or owning a bit of gold.
Yeah.
Because it's harder to rebalance inside a fund than it is inside an asset allocation framework. So constantly thinking about having liquidity to use when the market, gets nervous for whatever reason.
Yeah. And how do you, you might meet with potential families or so forth that are interested in investing in you, but do you end up turning people away? Like, does that play out at all?
Yeah, definitely.
It sounds like you obviously, you know, there's a particular type of family that you suit. Yeah, can you talk about that?
Yeah, definitely. You have to be prepared to send people away if they're there for the wrong reasons and they're there for a quick win. And you can get that sense pretty quickly. Oh, I can now. Do they have that sort of trading gambling mindset which you referenced? And are they chasing our recent returns, or are they genuine believers in compounding over the long term? Because, I mean, we write a quarterly, and I spoke about this. Getting your clients right is more important than getting your asset allocation right, from some perspective, because you want them to be there and buying into your philosophy when the market And we run this process with clients. I mean, when the markets or your portfolio is down 20% and you're asking them to perhaps deploy new capital, or you're trying to rebalance and they're being reluctant, like, that's the worst outcome for us. We need to be able to trust in our process, and we need our clients to trust in our process. If they're not willing to, then they're probably not the right client for us. So we write a lot, and we write quarterly, and that almost creates this self-fulfilling bringing the right people to us, and the wrong people just won't read what we write or buy into our style. So yeah. Super important.
Or they read it and they don't like it, so then they don't.
Yes.
They don't.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That kind of education piece that you're kind of referring to, is that are you doing that like directly with the end client, like the family whose money it is, or is there someone in between, like an advisor of sorts in between? Yeah, what does that look like?
Yeah, it varies. Some of the families have people in place that we deal with. We still deal with the patriarch or matriarch or the next generation down from time to time.
Yeah,
if they have skill sets, and I'm a big believer in bringing the next generation through and getting them to appreciate how this all works, because that's selfishly, that's about protecting our business as well. Because if they don't understand what we're doing at some point in time, we've devoted, you know, some of these cases, 10 years to these people, who could turn us away when those assets transition. So,
yes.
But also just a believer in financial literacy and improving elements across society, and especially in some of these larger families, you make the presumption that they're very sophisticated and literate, and in some cases they're just not, because mum and dad have been so busy inside a business for so long, they just haven't had the time. So I'm going off on a tangent, but
it's kind of in that kind of wholesale sophisticated investor definition that there's less disclosures and bits and pieces that you need to have for certain people with certain assets or certain income. Just because someone's operated a business in a particular field and they've sold it for $50 million and they've got all this cash now, doesn't necessarily mean that they're a sophisticated investor. They happen to have done really well in operating their business and they've had this liquidity event. Great.
Yeah.
But for them to then turn around and assume, and it certainly sounds like you don't assume, but for them to turn around and for someone in your position to assume that they know what you're talking about or know what you're doing or how you're managing the portfolio, it can be two completely different worlds, which is, you know, what you're saying right at the very start. But
I
like this kind of education mindset that you've got about what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Hmm. So where do your clients come from? Or how do they find you?
Mixed bag. Most of them are client referrals, to be honest. I think it's almost all word of mouth. We don't do a lot of marketing. We do a little bit of PR, but very rarely. Yeah, it's mostly people that had a reasonable experience and told some friends about the service they've got, or it's a traditional path through it for an accountant or a lawyer who thinks we might align with the values of someone who's had a liquidity event.
Yeah, and I'm sure that the writing that you said that you do on a quarterly basis, I'm sure that helps in there. That's a little bit. That's, you know, probably an easy intro. It's easy for someone to share that with their friend or their client or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Josh, if anyone wants to, we might kind of round it out now, but for anyone that wants to reach out to you, find out a little bit more about the business, where can they find you? How can anyone get in touch?
Yeah, I mean, probably best to start with the website, Elvia Asset Partners, and you can read some of the insights and get a sense of how we think. And then obviously I'm more than happy to talk to anyone, but we've got a reasonable sized team now. We have a CEO who came across recently, so allows me to run the investment team and do a little bit less of the initial client engagement. He's pretty good at filtering out the people.
Nice. And wherever anyone's listening to this, we'll put some links to the website and, you know, your LinkedIn page and all of these kind of things.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you.
Contact if they want. Thanks, Josh. Thanks for joining me this afternoon.
No worries. Appreciate it.